Our reading today is Psalm 19, and you can find it on page 390 of the Bibles. And this psalm is one person's answer to the question, what kind of book is the Bible? Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. In the heavens he has pitched a tent for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming forth from his pavilion, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are sure and altogether righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the comb. By them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then will I be blameless, innocent of great transgression. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer.
Show us Christ is what we've just sung. Well, if we're going to know more of Christ, then we need to have confidence about the Gospels that claim to show us Christ. And that's why we're asking the question this afternoon, who chose the Gospels? And I want to start by drawing our attention to words printed on the sheet. See where it says, hearing the word of the Lord. There are some words taken from the beginning of Luke's Gospel. And Luke writes, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you've been taught. Do you see why Luke is writing his gospel? That Theophilus, the person he's writing it for, and the rest of us who are to read it, may know the certainty of the things we've been taught. The things we've been taught about Jesus. That we may be confident that he said the things that we read he said in the gospels. That he did the things the gospel writers claim that he did. So if Theophilus was wobbling, if he was not quite sure, can we really believe that he said those things, that he did those things? How can we be sure that it's not just some kind of a legend? Or if we're wobbling, Luke wants us to be certain. He wants us to be able to land with confidence on the conviction that it's not a legend. It's true. It's real. You can be certain. In 2006, the magazine National Geographic trumpeted the publication in English of a translation of the Gospel of Judas. And I remember having several conversations with people at the time who were somewhat taken aback. Is it what, there are other Gospels? There's a Gospel of Judas? Yeah, there's a Gospel of Peter, there's a Gospel of Mary, there's a Gospel of Thomas, there's a Gospel of Nicodemus, there's a Gospel of the Hebrews, there's a Gospel of the Egyptians, there's a Gospel of the Ebionites. There are a lot of other Gospels. I couldn't bring it in, but I've got a book at home, which is sort of a fat copy of a book with the texts from about kind of 40 documents claiming to be Gospels or writings about Jesus that are not in the New Testament. One writer speaks of a sea of multiple gospels. And the very striking thing is that most of these Gospels, the ones that are not in the New Testament, present a Jesus who is very different from the Jesus of Luke or Matthew or Mark or John. In the Gospel of Judas, for example, Jesus laughs at his disciples in rather a cruel way. He laughs at their Jewish views of a creator God. The Jesus in Judas's gospel, the gospel of Judas, says it's all about not the creator God, it's all about the God within you. There's constant reference to our need for enlightenment. In the gospel of Thomas, there's no real narrative. There's nothing about Jesus's sort of ministry and death and resurrection. It's a collection of sayings. Some allude to things that Jesus says in the gospels in the New Testament. There's lots of material that's very different, though. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus is not uniquely the Son of God, come to save us by dying on a cross. He is a teacher of spiritual enlightenment. So one verse at the beginning of near the beginning of the Gospel of Thomas says, "When you come to know yourselves, you will be known. You will understand you are children of the living Father. But if you will not know yourselves, then you are in poverty." Do you see? In Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the way to become children of God is to put your trust in Jesus, the one who died and rose from the dead to save you. In Thomas, the way to be children of God, did you catch that, is to know yourself. When you read that, isn't that kind of unsettling? I was reading an article recently about a man who discovered late in life that his father had been married before and had a family that this guy knew nothing about. And it totally threw him. He thought he knew the truth of his dad. And all of a sudden, he wasn't quite sure what the truth was anymore. It made him feel like he didn't really know his dad. It made it feel like it was hard to trust his dad. We can understand that, can't we? And we read of these other Gospels and we find ourselves asking, well, which Jesus is the real Jesus then? Is the Jesus of the New Testament Gospel says, "I have come from God to live and die and rise from the dead to give you a relationship with God. If you want a relationship with God, a living relationship with God as your Father in heaven, look to me." Well, Thomas's Jesus says, the way to connect with the divine, the way to have a relationship with the divine, is to look within. Know yourself. That is pretty unsettling, isn't it? How come Luke's Jesus gets into the Bible and Thomas' Jesus doesn't? I mean, how do we know which of the real Jesus is? Well, the story doing the rounds is, well, the reason that happened is because there's been a great cover-up. Look at the chart on the sheet there. I'm sorry, it's rather a noddy chart, but I'm going to be talking a little bit, quite a lot about things like 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century, and if you're anything like me, it kind of takes a beat to remember the dates they refer to. So sort of 3rd century is really from sort of 200, 299, but if you're anything like me, you always get muddled. Start in the 4th century, which is 300 to 399, and the story people tell is up until the 4th century, there was a sea of Gospels. Loads of versions of Jesus, loads of versions of Christianity that were all kind of on an equal footing. And then, in 325, kind of quarter way through the 4th century, the Roman Emperor, Constantine, invited a load of bishops to a council in Nicaea, and all these men in pointy hats decided what the official version of Christianity was going to be. Read Dan Brown's account in the Da Vinci Code, and you'll know that, well, you don't necessarily know, but there's the character Salih Teabing says, more than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament. I don't know where he gets the figure 80 from, but anyway, 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament, and yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John among them. Who chose which Gospels to include? Sophie asked. Aha! Teabing burst in with enthusiasm. The fundamental irony of Christianity. The Bible as we know it today was collated by the pagan Roman Emperor Constantine the Great. See, the story goes, Constantine wanted to unite his empire, and so he imposed one version of Christianity. And because he was an emperor, he wanted to control people. So don't give them the Jesus who is all about inner enlightenment, the Jesus who says, look within and you too can become a God. Don't give them that. That is a dangerous idea. Give them the other Jesus. Give them the Jesus who says you can't save yourself. You need me to save you, because that'll keep them dependent. So it's Constantine who decides that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are in, and he then bans and burns all the other Gospels. And it's only now that we are discovering more and more of these banned books. Oh, these books are rocking all that we ever thought about Jesus. That's the story that does the rounds. The only trouble is that story is a myth. Questions about which books should be included in the New Testament were not talked about at Nicaea. You can read the minutes. But the myth has a kind of hold on us. It has a hold on us because it tells a story of people in pointy hats in power suppressing freedom. We love a conspiracy story. You might say, ah, yeah, but I've done some research. What about in the late 4th century? What about 363 to 364, the Council of Laodicea? Well, it's true. The Council of Laodicea, they issued a statement saying that only canonical books, that's only books officially in the Old Testament and New Testament, were to be read in church, and they gave a list of what those books were, but it wasn't particularly controversial. There wasn't a tussle. It wasn't like, well, it could have gone the other way. You know, on another day, we might have got Judas, Mary, and Thomas in, and Luke and Matthew and Mark out. They were just clarifying the position of the church. And you say, yeah, but hold on. Why? Why the Gospel of Luke and not the Gospel of Thomas? I mean, even if it wasn't political power play, it's still unsettling, isn't it? Somewhere along the line, someone made a choice. Someone said the real Jesus is the Jesus of Luke, not the Jesus of Thomas. What if they made the wrong choice? And it seems to me in the last 200 years, people have really latched on to this story, this myth. There were lots of versions, so we can't really be sure which the right Jesus was. And so some people think, brilliant, love this. This is great, because it means we don't have to be so hung up about the Jesus of the New Testament. And if there are things he says in the Gospels, in the New Testament, that you can affirm, that's great. But if there are things he says that don't particularly resonate with you, just put them to one side. Because we can't really be sure about what the real Jesus said anyway. We've all got to find the Jesus who works for us. The Jesus, in fact, who helps us to know ourselves better. That's the issue. So others think this is great. Others panic. Because they're living for Jesus, the Son of God, the Lord of their lives. And the times when it's really hard to live for him, when it's really costly to follow him, when he calls us to go to live in a way that goes against the grain of culture. And you're thinking, what if the Jesus I am living for is not the real Jesus? Does that mean I'm wasting my time? Do you see, the stakes are very high. And Luke insists, I want you to know the certainty. Now, can I say at this point, I am not an expert on these things. It's a question that's unsettled me in the past, and I know it's unsettled others, and just over the last few months, I kind of set myself the task to look into it a little bit. So I just want to share with you some of the things I've found. First thing to say is we have always known about other Gospels. We've known that from writers in the 2nd and 3rd century referring to them. In 180, Irenaeus writes against the Gospel of Judas. We've always known there was a Gospel of Judas. It's only more recently we found it. In 235, Hippolytus mentions the Gospel of Thomas. And over the years, we've just found more and more ancient copies of these ancient Gospels. Famously, a whole stack of these Gospels and other writings that are not in the New Testament were found in 1945 here, Nag Hammadi in Egypt. And they found the kind of scrolls like that, and it was really exciting. And over time, scholars have built up this collection of ancient manuscripts of early Christian writings, some in the New Testament, some those that are not in the New Testament. And they dated many of those manuscripts to the kind of 2nd and 3rd centuries. That's not necessarily when they were originally written, that's the age of the copies we found. So, for example, There is the oldest fragment of John's Gospel. It's from the middle of the second century. You can go and look at it in a library in Manchester. There is the oldest fragment of Matthew's Gospel from the late second century. There is the oldest fragment of the Gospel of Mary, third century. And what people do is they pull all the fragments and the copies together, and they see how many kind of gospels and documents didn't make it into the Bible, and it seems to tell this story. It tells the story of how in early Christianity there were all kinds of ideas floating around on a sea of gospels. And all those gospels were equally valid. And it could just as easily have been Thomas that became mainstream and Luke that became marginalized. The two problems with that view, first of all, is when you do add up all the texts we've got from the second and third century, the number of canonical texts, texts from books that are in the New Testament, way outnumber the non-canonical, which is at least interesting. You say, yeah, there are loads of books going around, but the fact that there were more copies of the four than the rest of them put together might suggest it's the four that became mainstream, that were in demand, well before any council ever decided anything. The truth is, numbers are not always that helpful. I mean, because we're always finding more. We've not actually got evidence of how many there were. We've just got evidence of how many we've found. And the fact that so many non-canonical texts were found at Nag Hammadi in Egypt kind of skews the numbers. Let me try and explain. My hero is the Irish writer Samuel Beckett. Okay, on my bookshelves at home, I have copies of everything he's written, all his plays, all his novels, his poems. I've got a couple of biographies on him and about, I think, sort of 14 or 15 other books about him and his work. I love Samuel Beckett. Now, imagine some kind of scenario where all the libraries and bookshelves of all the people in Bristol somehow destroyed in a fire, apart from mine. Okay, I don't quite know what sort of freak occasion, incident that would be, but imagine that, okay? And then in years to come, archaeologists find my bookshelves. And they look at my books, and they do the maths, and they come to the conclusion that Samuel Beckett was the most popular author for the people of Bristol in 2016. Okay, that the people of Bristol loved Samuel Beckett more than anyone else. What would you think of that conclusion? You think, it's a little bit suspect, isn't it? It's skewed by the fact that it's my bookshelves that they found. And Nag Hammadi is in Egypt. It's a place that was massively into, thank you very much, a religious movement called Gnosticism, which is basically a second century movement, which is all about enlightenment through knowledge. Gnosis means knowledge. There's no surprise that the religious literature you find in Egypt is not particularly Christian, it's Gnostic. And what they've done is they've tried to use the figure of Jesus to promote their Gnostic beliefs. So the fact that we find a lot of Gnostic versions of Jesus' teachings in Egypt doesn't necessarily mean everyone all around the world was into these sorts of gospels. There's just a sea of gospels, and they're all equally valid. One of the clues as to what everyone was into is to look at how the manuscripts were bound together. So by the third century, the sheets of papyrus that stuff was written on were bound together in these kind of book-type things called codices. And whenever you get gospels bound together, you never get Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Thomas. See, wherever you get multiple gospels bound together in a codex like this, you only ever get Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Could that mean, way before the Council of Laodicea, those four were already beginning to be seen as special in some way? Another clue as to what everyone was really into is to look at the size of the manuscript. If they are big, that means they were made for public reading. And most of the New Testament Gospels from the third century are big. There is one early copy of Thomas that's big enough for public reading, but most of the non-New Testament Gospels are small. In other words, for private reading. They were around, but for private reading. Some of them were not particularly Gnostic. They're just like a kind of Christian literature. Kind of like reading them was a bit like reading the Jesus Storybook Bible or something like that. So yeah, all kinds of literature is out there, but why were these four bound together? Why were these four made big for public reading? Did they have perhaps authority in the life of the church before the 4th century? Next place to look is 3rd century writers. So we're going to go back in time, okay? 3rd century writers, you've got in 226, Origen of Alexandria in Egypt says, the church has 4 gospels, heretics have many. Kind of put that in your pipe and smoke it is kind of what he's saying. 2007-2012, Tertullian says, of the apostles, therefore, John and Matthew first instill faith into us, whilst of apostolic men, Luke and Mark renew it afterwards. Notice 4. 202, Hippolytus, he's writing a commentary on Daniel, the book of Daniel in the Old Testament, almost just as an aside, says Christ is preached in the world through the fourfold gospel. So you see, the idea, the story we've been told, that it's not until the 4th century that anyone gets hold of these 4, and up till then there's a sea of gospels, all equally valid, it isn't what the research tells us. These guys are writing in the 3rd century. They start to talk about these 4 gospels as the authentic gospels then. Some say, yeah, well, we all know why that is, don't we? We all know why that is. The reason everyone's talking about 4 gospels is because of this fellow, Irenaeus. Irenaeus was a bishop of Lyon in France, and one writer says, well, if you want to blame someone for the fact we've only got these 4 gospels as official, he's the one to blame. He hacked down the forest of gospels so that only 4 were left standing, is what one writer says. So about the year 180, in his book Against Heresies, another cheerful sounding book, he says this: it's not possible that the Gospels can be either more or fewer in number than they are. For since there are 4 zones of the world in which we live and 4 principal winds, while the church is scattered through the world, it is fitting that the church should have 4 pillars. He who has manifested to men has given us the gospel under 4 aspects, bound together by one spirit. And people go, well, there you go. See, it's Irenaeus. He's the one. He's the one who first argues for 4 gospels. But it's not a very good argument, is it? There must be 4 gospels because there are 4 winds. I mean, can you imagine anyone who's a big fan of the Gospel of Thomas going, oh, right then, yeah. 4 winds, 4 gospels. Let's burn Thomas. You see? It's not a very persuasive argument. But the point is, he's not having to make the argument. He's not saying, get rid of all the other gospels because there are 4 winds. He's not saying that. He's just saying, as there are 4 winds, there are 4 gospels. And that is fitting. That's the language he uses, fitting. So he's not trying to persuade anyone 4 is the magic number. He's just saying, what is the case? What is accepted? And it's fitting. It turns out he's not the only 4 gospel man at the end of the 2nd century. So you get this guy, Clement of Alexandria, who writes a load of stuff and in his writings quotes various other Christian writings, the gospels. He quotes Matthew 757 times and Luke 400, you can read the numbers. Out of a total of 1,672 quotes, there's only 14 times when he quotes non-canonical gospels. And I've looked at some of those references, and he says things like, this is what it says in the Gospel of the Egyptians, but this is what Luke says. In other words, he quotes in order to make the comparison, to distinguish. There's another guy, not time to go into this in so much detail, but there's another guy called Serapion, who was involved in a dispute about the Gospel of Peter. Some people are wondering whether they could read the Gospel of Peter in the church gathering in public. And having looked into it, he decides that no, they can't because it's not an authentic gospel. There's another little thing here. This is called the Muratorian Fragment. It's a piece of ancient text from the 2nd century. It's found in 1740. And it's really fascinating because although there's stuff missing from it, there's a section that goes, well, it's missing. And then it picks up, the 3rd book of the gospel is that according to Luke. Luke, the well-known physician. The 4th of the Gospels is that of John, one of the disciples. Do you see the significance of that? Although the early part of the text is missing, it's clear he's saying the 1st, and then the 2nd, and then the 3rd and the 4th. We may not know for sure who he names as the 1st and the 2nd, but at very least we can be sure he thinks of 4. So, before the 4th century, there was this sea of Gospels. No. Look at this map. If you can understand this map, it's my best attempt to try and get a map up on screen. What's so interesting about this is you've got this is the second century, and you've got Irenaeus in Gaul in France, talking about four Gospels. You've got the Muratorian fragment, Rome, talking about four Gospels. You've got people in Antioch in Syria, Serapion and his mate Theophilus, talking about four Gospels. And you've got Clement in Alexandria in Egypt, talking about four Gospels, basically. Now, what's so interesting is this is in the second century. This is when the church had no centralized leadership. No councils met. And yet somehow, across the Roman Empire, in these very different parts, people were talking about these four Gospels. Why? We'll come back to that. We can go even further back to the 170s, when a fellow called Tatian, Syrian, put together a harmony of the Gospels. He wanted to weave together all the Gospels into one continuous narrative. He called it the Diatessaron, which means through the fall. So in other words, when he thought about pulling together all the Gospels, he thought about pulling together the four Gospels. Okay, moving further back in time to the mid-century. Have I got a slide for this? Yes, I do. Here's a fellow called Justin, okay? Justin, in 150, wrote a couple of books called Apologies, which kind of sound like English books. I'm so sorry. it just means they're apologetics in the sense that they were defenses of the Christian faith. And he addressed it to the secular authorities. There's another book he wrote a little bit later, which is a dialogue to a friend of his who was a Jew. And people say, in Justin, why doesn't he explicitly mention Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Why not give chapter and verse? And Justin himself says it's because he knows that quoting chapter and verse is not going to help him win his argument. He's writing to skeptics. You know that if you're a Christian, when you talk to a friend who's perhaps an atheist, there's no point saying, but it says in John chapter 5, verse 13. That doesn't wash. You have to make your case, not just cite your texts. And that's what Justin does. He makes his case, and he does it with material that he calls Gospels. And he explains what the Gospels are to his secular audience by saying they were memoirs of the apostles. And we say, well, okay, we read through his stuff. Which Gospels does he have in view? Well, he uses phrases from Matthew and from Luke, and he talks about Jesus changing Peter's name from Simon, which is something you only get in Mark's Gospel. And one of the most exciting bits is at one point, Justin writes, Jesus said, except ye be reborn, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. See, the only gospel that we know of, whether inside or outside the New Testament, that uses language of being born again is John. John chapter 3, where Jesus talks to Nicodemus. And Justin goes on and says, now, that it is impossible for those who have once been born to enter into their mother's wombs is manifest to all. You see, he quotes the very objection that Nicodemus makes in John chapter 3. In other words, it looks like he has got John's gospel in front of him. See, Justin knew all sorts of Christian literature, but in his arguments, he never cites material other than what you can find in the four Gospels. And there's some great moments. In his argument with the Roman emperor, he urges him to look into our writings, which are called the Gospels. See, look into them, he says. In other words, he's assuming the emperor could get hold of the Gospel, that the emperor could go into his local branch of Waterstones and buy the Gospels. And he doesn't say, of course, you need to be careful. There's a whole sea of Gospels out there. It's just these particular four I'm talking about. When he tells the emperor to look into the Gospels, he's just assuming that he will look at the ones he means, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. One of the most famous opponents of Christianity, writing in sort of 160-ish, attacks Christianity. A guy called Celsus attacks Christianity, and the quotations he uses are all from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Let's pull this together. What's striking to me, anyway, is in the kind of mid-second century, about 150-ish, when people are talking about the Christian faith, when people are talking about the Gospels, they're not talking about loads of different versions. They're talking about one version, the version represented in the four Gospels that we know. And we can push it back even earlier. After Christmas, I spent some time reading the letters of some of the earliest Christians. You get it in a Penguin edition. It's absolutely fascinating. And there's this one guy, Ignatius, who was bishop in Syria, who there is a painting of him about to be eaten by that particular lion. Basically, he is on his way to being killed in 108 AD. And on his way to his death, he writes a series of letters to Christians around about the place. And in those letters, he refers to Paul's letters, and he refers to various of the kind of incidents and sayings that we find in the four Gospels. And what really struck me as I read this is that the Jesus he speaks of, the Jesus he loves and follows, is not the Jesus of Thomas, not the teacher of enlightenment. The Jesus he speaks of is one that we would recognize from the four Gospels. Let me just read a snippet. I'm awaiting some new glasses, actually, but I'm having a rather odd time of it at the moment. I'm doing the kind of things that my mother used to do, which is... oh, dear. It's tiny print. It is tiny print. Okay, this is Ignatius. As for me, my spirit is now all humble devotion to the cross which so greatly offends the unbelievers, but is salvation and eternal life to us. And I could give you loads of other references like that, but the point is you would never get a sentence like that in the Gospel of Thomas. The cross and the resurrection don't feature. But you see what excites him? What excites him is the Christ who died for him. And it's in what Christ has done that there is salvation and life. You get a similar thing in Clement, he's Bishop of Rome. He writes in 96 AD, so even earlier than Ignatius. And again, the Jesus he talks about is not the Jesus of the Gospel of Thomas. He quotes the New Testament letter to the Hebrews that we read right at the beginning. He quotes the bit about Jesus being the Son of God who sits at the right hand of the Father. He doesn't present Jesus as a teacher of enlightenment. He presents him as the unique Son of God. You say, yeah, but you know. Perhaps there are other versions kicking about, and it's just that these guys happened to latch on to this version. It was just this was the Jesus they chose. Key to understanding why the earliest Christians chose this Jesus, or went for this Jesus, is their view of the apostles. Let me try and explain. My grandfather was killed in the Second World War, just before my dad was born. And a few years ago, my dad wanted to find out about his father. Who do you think he wanted to speak to find out the truth about his father and the circumstances of his death, which were always shrouded in a little bit of mystery? The people who knew him. The people who were there. And what he did is he tracked down his father's squadron. And when they had a kind of reunion, he met up with them. And he heard about his father. He grilled them about his father. You see, when you love someone, you don't just say, well, I don't know, I'll make up stories about them. But, you know, which version shall I go for? You really want to know the truth. It really matters. So you really want to talk to the people who can give you the truth. And that's the impulse of the first Christians. See, the claims about Jesus were so big, the stakes so high, follow Jesus and you could get killed for it. You don't just go, well, what are the versions that are floating around? Let's see which are the ones you think work for us. Do I like the sound of it? No, you say, hold on, is there anyone we can get to who can give us the truth? Is there anyone who witnessed this? You need to know if this is worth getting thrown to the lions for. And so they looked at the apostles. They looked to the people who were with Jesus. And the question was, have those people, the people who were with Jesus, left us any evidence to be going on? Do you remember old Irenaeus, the four winds guy? He does actually make an argument for there being four gospels, but it's not the four winds. He writes this, Matthew also used a written gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect while Peter and Paul were preaching at Rome and laying the foundations of the church. After their departure, Mark, the disciple interpreter of Peter, did also hand down to us in writing what had been preached by Peter. Luke, also the companion of Paul, recorded in a book the gospel preached by him. Afterwards, John, the disciple of the Lord, who also had leaned upon his breast, did himself publish a gospel during his residence at Ephesus in Asia. Do you see? Why these four Gospels? Not because they were four winds, but because of their links with the apostles. Matthew, one of the disciples. Mark, the interpreter of Peter. Peter was one of the disciples. He probably spoke in Aramaic, and Mark wrote it up in Greek so the rest of the world could understand it. Luke wrote down what he got from the apostle Paul. We started with Luke. He did all the investigation. He checked out the eyewitness accounts. John, he says, is the one who leaned upon the breast of Jesus. In other words, he was Jesus' closest friend. And he wrote down what he remembered. So it's very striking, isn't it? That's why Irenaeus says, go back to these four Gospels. It's because they're linked with the apostles. It's very striking. After Christmas, I was reading Ignatius. He was talking about the authority of the apostles. He says, look, I'm not issuing an order as though I was an apostle. He says, I'm just a bishop. You see, what he's saying is, I'm not an apostle. They are the ones you should listen to. They are the ones who speak with authority about Jesus. I'm just a bishop. Clement says a similar thing. Actually, I probably haven't quite got time to read it, but Clement talks about how important it is to understand that God sent Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ sent the apostles, and the apostles preached the gospel. And that's really important to the thinking of the first Christians, the apostles. That's why they focus on Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Because these are the documents that are tied to the apostles, the people who are with Jesus. You see? And that's how you get access to eyewitness evidence. But you say, well, hold on, where did this whole idea come from? That these books were from the apostles? How did that spread? Well, one strand you could follow is Irenaeus, our friend Irenaeus, Four Winds man, when he's writing in 180, he talks about how he was taught by a guy called Polycarp. Polycarp was martyred in 156. So Irenaeus is remembering what Polycarp taught him when Irenaeus was quite young. And this is what he writes. Let's see if I can focus on this. This is Irenaeus writing. He says, I distinctly recall the events of that time better than those of recent years, for what we learn in childhood keeps pace with the growing mind and becomes part of it, so that I can tell the very place where the blessed Polycarp used to sit as he discoursed, his goings out, his comings in, the character of his life, his bodily appearance, the discourses he would address to the multitude, how he would tell of his conversations with John and with the others who'd seen the Lord. Now he would relate their words from memory. Do you see? Polycarp was born in AD 70. John died in 100. So in his 20s and 30s, Polycarp is hanging out with John and the others who'd been with Jesus. And later, he then teaches what he learned from John to Irenaeus. Do you see? So where did Irenaeus get his ideas about who wrote the gospel from? From Polycarp. Where did Polycarp get his ideas from? From John. One of the disciples, one of the authors. There's another guy called Papias, who's a bishop of Hierapolis in between 110 and 130. He had heard John preach. And he wrote how he would often seek out those who'd been with Jesus or knew his disciples. He says, for unlike most people, I took no pleasure in those who told many different stories, but only in those who taught the truth. And you see what he's saying? He's like, I want to know the truth. And if you want to know the truth, you go to those who are closest to Jesus. Who chose the Gospels? That's our question. It's not that in the 4th century, or even the 3rd century, or even the 2nd century, some council sat down and said, now, which Jesus should we go for? Which Gospel should we choose? The claims about Jesus were massive. People were saying that this Jesus was not just another teacher of spiritual enlightenment. He was the Son of God, which meant you needed to know the truth about Jesus. It meant every generation asked the question, how do we get to the truth? How can we be sure? Which means you've got to go to those who are closest to him. You've got to go to the apostles. So you're asking, so where do we go to find out what the apostles taught? And the answer from the very beginning was you go to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. See, the apostles, they spent their lives preaching about what Jesus had taught them. And the reason they wrote the Gospels down was to have a lasting witness to Jesus once they had died. So who chose the Gospels? I think we could say nobody chose the Gospels. Rather, Christians received them. They received them. Because from the start, they wanted to know what will put us in touch with Jesus. And from the start, the only answer anyone ever gave was these Gospels. Say, hold on. Hold on. Thomas, Peter, Mary, weren't those people who had first-hand experience of Jesus? Why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Why not Thomas, Peter, Mary, Nicodemus, Judas? Most scholars agree that the Gospels we've got, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are written between sort of 60 and 90 AD. Some would say they're done by 70, actually. In other words, the apostles wrote up the things they'd been teaching before they died in order to pass it on. But the non-canonical Gospels, most scholars would date as later into the second century, well after Mary and Peter and Thomas and Nicodemus had died. In other words, that they are not... they're not eyewitness accounts. Now, there's not time for a full case as to why, but here's something of why they think that's the way to think. The earliest Gospels were found outside of the land they were set in, okay? So I want you to imagine you are writing a story set 100 years ago in France, okay? And you need to pass it off as an authentic eyewitness account. What sort of challenges will you face in order to pull that off? One of the big challenges is you'll need to get the names right. You see, what were French people called 100 years ago? What do you think? I mean, you just can't call everyone in your story Pierre or Marie-Claude, yeah? You have to know what are the other names that were typical of the time. And you'll need to get the details right. You need to get the details of the little villages that the characters live in right. You'll need to know how long it takes to walk between the villages. You'll need to know the names of the local dignitaries, the local mayor, the person who ran the bakery. Okay? Now, think of doing that in the second century. No Wikipedia. No period dramas on TV. There are books you could consult, but those books are about great battles and famous emperors and cities you should visit before you die. They are not really about village life. See, it's hard. How are you going to do that in the second century? Pull off an authentic-sounding story about life in first-century Palestine. And the point is, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John pass the authenticity test. When people appear in the narrative, they're mostly named. And they're named with the sort of names people would have had. The most common name in the Gospels is Simon. The most common name in first century Palestine at the time of Jesus was Simon. And that's why all the Simons get a qualifier. Because everyone's going, Simon, which Simon? There are so many Simons. Well, there's Simon of Cyrene, there's Simon the leper, there's Simon Peter, Simon the zealot. Whereas Bartholomew is just Bartholomew. Because there weren't many Bartholomews, you see? How did they know that? How did they know to make that kind of differentiation? And in the Gospels like Thomas and Judas, you don't get many names, certainly not of any of the incidental characters. You get Jesus, you get Judas, you get Mary, Thomas, the lead characters, but then you get a load of names like Barbello and Yobel and Nebal and Sackless. In other words, you get Egyptian names. Do you see? That is a clue that the author of Gospels like Judas and Thomas is at home in the world of Egyptian names, but doesn't really know much about first century Palestine. You see the same thing in the place names. The Gospels in the New Testament are full of place names, not just famous names like Jerusalem, but little villages like Bethpage, or however you quite pronounce that. And the writers of the Gospels know how long it takes to walk between these villages, and they know the local routes. In the non-canonical Gospels, the only place name mentioned is Jerusalem. It's mentioned in two of them. The rest of them have no place names. Do you see? Do you see what that means? It means people say, of course, you can't really know what happened about Jesus of Nazareth. All these Gospels, I mean, they were written years after the events. They're all just legends, really. That's true of the non-canonical Gospels. That's true. Because they don't include the sort of detail you'd expect from eyewitnesses. They don't pass the authenticity test. But Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they do. C.S. Lewis, the famously, I suppose, the author of the Narnia stories, but he did one or two other things as well. He says, I've been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, myths all my life. He was a professor of medieval literature. I know what they are like. I know that not one of them is like this. He's talking about John's Gospel. Of this text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, or else some unknown writer in the second century, without known predecessors or successors, has suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern, novelistic, realistic narrative. See, could it be that they read like reportage, the canonical Gospels, as opposed to the ones outside the Gospel, because they are reportage. They are eyewitness accounts. That's what the first Christians were convinced of. That's why they latched onto them. So friends, if someone says, look, of course, Jesus started out as a good man, a teacher of spiritual enlightenment, and then what happened was, you see, over time, he got promoted to being this unique Son of God. Now, what we need to do is we need to go back to the original, the pure Jesus. If someone says that to you, you need to know that the earliest evidence we have on him, the earliest writings about him, have him as the Son of God. It's the later writings, the Gnostic influenced writings, that have him as the spiritual teacher. So to go back to the original, the pure Jesus, is actually to go back to the one who made very lofty claims. If someone says in response to that, oh, of course, but but until the 4th century, there were loads of different Jesuses going around, loads of different Gospels, loads of different versions. It's only in the 4th century when the men in pointy hats decided on, that's wide of the mark. From the very outset, the church wanted to know the truth, which means they wanted to hear the apostles. So they gathered around the Gospels that were linked to the apostles. Some people I know that I speak to, they say, well, you can never really know anything about the history of the early church and the truth about Jesus. It's all just shrouded in mystery. You can never be certain. And they kind of, that's their reason for not really going there, not really looking into the claims of Christ. One of the things that's really struck me as I've looked at this is just how much we can know, how certain we can be. Just to close, though, why does it matter? I mean, okay, great. So we can be certain about the truth of Jesus. So what? Just have a look at the verses, far right-hand side of your sheet. John, sort of towards the end of his gospel, where it says, responding to the word of the Lord, under there. John, towards the end of his gospel, says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. See, I've written this that you may have life. He's saying, without this Jesus, you are dead. With this Jesus, oh, you have new life. You have the life you were created for. The life in a relationship with God as your Father in heaven. Life that starts now. Life that lasts forever. And it seems to me the best way to get to the bottom of this is read John's gospel for yourself. What do you make of the Jesus you meet in the pages of John's gospel? What does he strike you as? Legendary or real? Down the ages, so many people have said, well, it's just not relevant to me. I'm just not that bothered. But then they have sort of reluctantly read John's gospel and they have been gripped by the Jesus whom they meet on its pages. And it's changed everything. I just urge you, if you've never done that, to do that for yourself. I need to stop there. We're going to have a chance for questions. We always have a chance for questions here at Emmanuel. Conscious of time, it means we'll have a moment of quiet just to kind of clarify what our questions are. Some hats will go around. They're not for a collection. They're for putting your questions in. And then we'll sing while we gather those questions up, and we'll just look at some of them together. Okay.
My name is Claire Darley. I'm one of the people who come here every week, and I'm just going to ask some of these questions to Mike. There's loads here, so I'm really sorry if I don't ask yours, but I'm going to try and have a bit of a fair sample of what we've got. So just to clarify for
yes.
people, questions first, Mike. Quite a few questions about who actually wrote the non-canonical Gospels. Yeah. The Gospel of Mary, Thomas, were they actually written by Mary and Thomas or not?
I think we can confidently say no. Not written by Mary and Thomas. You see what they've done there? They've given it a sort of the title of someone who sounds like they'd be influential and would have first-hand evidence of experience of Jesus. But the very fact that all the evidence points to their being written in the mid-second century means, you know, Mary and Thomas and Nicodemus would have been dead. Okay. I think we can be pretty confident that they were not written by those people.
Not written there. Okay, great, thanks. Similarly, sort of on the other hand, Jesus' promise of divine authority and infallibility is made in the Apostle Gospels.
Yes.
Is it a problem that Luke and Mark weren't actually apostles themselves? They were relying on second sources themselves. Yeah. Is that
That's
an
a good
issue?
Question. I think the key is, well, what was Mark doing? Mark is claiming to, or the understanding is that Mark got his material from Peter. He described as the interpreter of Peter, in other words, the translator of Peter, the interpreter in that sense of Peter. So Peter perhaps preaching in Aramaic, Mark writing it in Greek. The business of Luke was a travel companion with Paul, and you can well imagine Luke traveling around with Paul and writing down the stuff that Paul was saying, but also meeting all kinds of people along the way and going, and the rest of the disciples, and saying, tell me more about Jesus, and he's making his notes. So I think that's they are well able to gather together material, because they're not just sitting down one Wednesday afternoon kind of 30 years after the event saying, now let's write a story about Jesus. They're saying these are the blocks of teaching that are going round, and actually some of them have already been written down to pass out, and what they're doing is gathering them in, but they're gathering them in as it were under the auspices of the apostolic band. There's not some sort of maverick Luke over here writing a load of stuff saying, let's slip this in. He's writing it under the supervision of Paul and Mark with Peter and those kinds of things.
Great, thank you. So the sort of final question really is around the discrepancies between the canonical Gospels that we've got. So we've got these four Gospels. Yeah. They're not identical. Is that helpful to the argument, or is that a hindrance? Does people for going either way, can't they?
This is a slightly crude answer, but if they were all exactly the same, you would suspect a stitch-up, wouldn't you? I mean, if you've got four witnesses in a court of law, and they didn't just talk about similar things, but they actually were identical, you would worry. Mm-hmm. But it's true that Matthew, Mark, and Luke use some of the same source material that's going around. But they put it together differently. That is their attempt to represent it. It's not just, we've agreed our story, folks, let's go with that. So I think actually some of the differences reflect same events, but a different angle on it, from a different witness who saw it a little bit differently, who remembered a different feature of it, and those kinds of things.
So sort of add depth rather than confusion.
I think so, and if you're thinking of particular difficult incidents, you think, how do we fit those together? Let's talk about them.
Great. Thanks very much, Mike.